Hey guys, before we roll into this next episode, I wanted to thank you all for the kind words that you've left on social media and for all of you that you have subscribed and left reviews. Those reviews help me keep this podcast free. So thanks again and enjoy the next episode. Hi, and welcome to another edition of Interviews with the Haunting Masters. We have a special live podcast tonight. Got three of probably the best mule deer hunters that I know of in the country right now sharing their knowledge with us this evening. And we're going to be getting into some questions and taking questions from you guys that are out there in Facebook land watching this and following along. We're going to get started by introducing you guys, and we'll start off with, I got Chad sitting next to me. Go ahead, Chad, introduce yourself.
Chad Roberts.
And
how you guys doing?
Why don't you give us a little quick rundown about yourself real quick?
Yuma, Arizona. Killed a few deer here and there.
Just a couple.
Enjoy the desert. That's really my strong point. Yep. An occasional elk. Killed an antelope.
Yeah, you're a pretty accomplished guy. So if you don't know, if you've been living under a rock, Chad probably killed one of the biggest deer ever in the desert here in Arizona. So we also got with us Travis Nowotny. Travis, how you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Good, man. Give us a little quick rundown about yourself.
Just an Idaho native here. I live here in Caldwell. Just love to hunt mule deer, elk, bears, you know, anything that I can hunt. I like to get out and enjoy the mountains. So that's about it in a gist, I guess.
And then we got the gray light hunter, Marlon Holden. How you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Good evening. How are you?
I'm great, man. Can't complain.
Awesome.
Just got done chowing down on some Flemings with Chad before we hit the old podcast. Got to fill the belly. So
I hear that.
Give us a quick rundown about yourself, just in case anybody out there that's watching this doesn't know who you are.
Southern California for now. Been here for like the last 20 years. It's an interesting place to be based out of when you love hunting mule deer because you have to go everywhere to do it. But it's been a good life. Father to a beautiful six-year-old little boy. He's going to be six in June. And enjoying God's way out in nature.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to actually start off with you. First question that I had sent over to me earlier today was directed at you. What do you accredit your consistent success to? Give me like three rules to live by or three things that you do that allow you to have the success that you have.
John, that's it's easy to answer in and of itself, but it's more the question that you really have to like look within on, right? Because a lot of people look for the quick, easy five tips to success or the 10 steps to freedom or what's going to make me better at this or that. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, because you're tenacious and you get it done too. It just comes down to work ethic. It comes down to drive. Like you can be half as skilled as the next guy, but have 10 times more determination and get it done because you just have more grit. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm the greatest hunter in the world, and I don't want to have like any type of like big chip on my shoulder. I mean, Travis and Chad are better than I am. I just, you know, I'm just like, I have an insane work ethic. I'll like totally freaking work anybody under the table. And that's all I, you know that I can bring to the table. So three things, I'm going to say attitude. I've spoken about attitude and ability before. You mm-hmm. have to have a great attitude and it has to be paired with some level of ability. If you don't have one of those, you're really not going to have consistent success. It's really going to be something that will be detrimental to you in the long run if you're lacking either one. And then, you know, consistency really comes down to the level of persistence and tenacity that you have, because the fact is we're all going to fail on these hunts, right? You have a bow in your hand, you're kind of set up at a disadvantage right from the start, from most people's perspective, like, oh gosh, I have a bow, you know, I'm going to take something down, a free range animal with a bow. And realistically, I mean, I've told this to a lot of different people, but it's just like having a rifle in your hand. You have to get accustomed to knowing that that's the only option that you have. And the moment that you decide in your head that you quit switching weapons and just decide, hey, I'm going to conquer bow hunting, you're going to be better at hunting in every aspect, whether it's rifle, muzzleloader, or a bow. You'll become really good once you decide to adopt a mentality of, you know, I'm only going to be a bow hunter. And that's not to say that there aren't great rifle hunters. This isn't a debate on bow or rifle. It just really comes down to the fact of when you decide to choose, and rifle hunting no longer becomes hard, it becomes easy, and then bow hunting becomes easy as a result of you deciding that that's the only weapon you choose. So tenacity and knowing you're going to fail is the biggest attribute to your success, with regard to the fact that you just don't quit. You fall, you get back up. You fall, you get back up. Mm-hmm. And every time you fall, it's a numbers game. The more you get back up and the more you stay with it, success will level in your odds. And then, you know, I mean, I really believe that those are, I would say in jest, the best three things I can come up with offhand right now.
Awesome. You know what? I'm going to throw that same question at the book to you guys. Go ahead, Travis. Why don't you give us what your what you attribute your success to? Give me the three things that you attribute your success to.
Well, I think Marlon hit it on the head a little bit there with, you know, just being not giving up and just going for it, going all in. And when things aren't thrown, you know, the cards aren't dealt your way, just to get back up and go for it. So I think, you know, I think attitude, how you go about it, just being tenacious, like you said, and you got to love it. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you're going to fail. So you've got to love failure. You've got to love being out in God's country, on the mountain, you know, hitting the desert, hitting the high country. You got to love it. I mean, it's all part of the game. So success is a small fraction of what hunting really is.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I tell people that all the time. I say, if you want to get into bow hunting, you gotta love everything about it, because if you're just in it to kill stuff, you're going to go home disappointed more often than not. You know, there's a lot of days where you go home, or a lot of tags that don't get filled, and you gotta be there for the whole thing. For the whole holistic part of bow hunting. So,
well, I think that, you know, I get asked a lot, we just make it seem like it's easy, and people don't see the failures and all the bumps in the road along the way. You know, John mentioned that big deer I killed a few years ago. You know, I failed numerous times on him. You know, that was I tested myself on that one, and just being persistent and not quitting. You know, I just spent this last weekend, you know, I burnt 16, 17 miles up out there, just learning new country, learning the ins and outs, new stuff. So I could, you know, see the whys and the whats. And when I go back later and I have activity going on there, you know, I'll have a reason. And it just makes things that much easier.
Yeah.
I'm going to chime in here real quick, and just to kind of tee off on what Chad said, you know, I get the unique privilege and perspective of being next to his side a lot of time through some of the scouting, and I'm not there half as much as he is. He lives there and he's been doing it. You know, he's the same age as I am, dang near, and 38 years old and been doing it his entire life. And I can attest to the fact the kind of country we cover when we're doing it is insane. I mean, hundreds of miles in a day. So when he says he's learning new country, it almost like makes my jaw drop to the floor, because, you know, I mean, the type of intimacy that he has with the country, he literally is in tune with the animals, like what they're doing, exactly what pattern they're in at that particular time. So when it's like go time, it's not even a thing for him. It's almost like they're his family members and he knows where they are and he just has to show up. I mean, but it's because of the fact that he's doing it right now, where everybody else is just like hoping they get a tag or not really caring. And he's got that work ethic. And so does Travis. I mean, I can attest to that with Travis too.
Yeah. Crazy. Every time I talk to Chad, or any of you guys, really, you're always doing something that's related to what you're going to be doing that season coming up. And I think that's the biggest thing with anybody who's really successful in hunting is that they spend the time and they pay attention to the details and really dissect what it is that they're trying to accomplish and find whatever information they can, whether through scouting or whatever, you know, to make it happen. It's doing anything and everything possible to make it happen. And, you know, my hat's off to the guys that can do that, you know, that's all dedication, you know, and not everybody, unfortunately, not everybody has the time too, but you got to make it, steal it, you know, borrow from Peter to pay Paul and steal it from whatever, to get in there and actually.
Well, here's the deal with time. I get the time question a lot. I've got a family and I spend lots of time with them. I go to the gym every day. I work just like everybody else does. What changes is I don't go to the bar. I don't watch football on Sundays. I don't go to my buddy's house for barbecue.
Yep.
You know, that's.
Yep. I give up a lot of that stuff too.
Figure out what you want and go for it.
That's such a huge key point you just said there, Chad. Like, I know Travis and Chad like the back of my hand. They are literally my brothers that I wasn't born from the same mother or father. Like, I mean, they're brothers. I would literally freaking do whatever it took to drag them off the mountain. That's how much I have love for them. And it's interesting that all of us share that same kind of weird behavior. We don't care about what everybody else is doing, what's going on. It's the task at hand. Like, that's something that I can – Chad hit the nail on the head with that one.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to jump into a couple questions here. One of the questions we got was, and I get this often, and I ask this of a lot of guests, and I think it's always a good question. What are some of the things that you do to choose your hunting spot before you get boots on the ground? You know, give me a couple of things of what you're doing before you actually get out there and start scouting, and then we'll actually get into when you're out there scouting. Actually, I want Chad to get into the scouting part when we get to that part, because he's unique, like you were saying. He makes those deer his family members and whatnot. So go ahead. One of you guys, Travis, you want to start off with what, you know, some of the things you do, and then we'll let Marlon pipe in right there.
Sure. You know, a lot of my, I don't know, a lot of the stuff I look for is, you know, a lot of it comes down to just like a gut intuition. You know, I have these places that, you know, especially here in Idaho, I've been through, you know, most of the state, and I have these places in the back of my head, you know, the places that I drive by or whatever I look, and it just looks like good deer country to me. So, I've got a list, and I'll go through and I'll check these areas out. I'll check them for deer numbers, that kind of thing first. And if there's deer numbers there, then, you know, that's when I'll really start to put boots on the ground. You know, I'll look for, you know, a secluded sagebrush basin that's got some springs in it and a lot of bitterbrush and that kind of thing that I know could hold, you know, an older age class buck. And, you know, then a lot of it just comes to boots on the ground. A lot of the high country stuff, it's, you know, you kind of got to know a mule deer's, you know, habits for the most part. You know, I tend to look for open country. For one, you know, the mule deer, if we're hunting them early, they're in the velvet and their antlers are a little tender and they like to stay out in the open in these big basins and stuff so they can, you know, not bump their antlers and really feed on the high mountain vegetation that's open to sunlight. So another thing I'll look for is those high springs, those secluded springs that, you know, like where elk, they they need a lot more water. So big key water sources, you know, creek drainages, that kind of thing, tend to keep the elk in that particular area. But high on the mountains where there's just a spring or something like that, that can really hold mule deer, support mule deer and keep them away from the elk, you know, because most of the deer in our country, if there's a bunch of elk, you're not going to see a bunch of deer. So
right,
that's the same with here too.
Yeah, same here. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
in other states that I've hunted too, Montana, I think that's pretty common. mainly, I think, because even though mule deer are browsers and elk are grazers, I think mule deer tend to find most of their, like the forbs and stuff they're eating, in the same type of grass. So they're almost in competition with each other. So go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but.
Oh, that's all right. I mean, I don't really have a real recipe. That's basically what I'm getting at is, you know, I don't have some set guideline that I do, you know, throughout growing up, I kind of just, you know, I wanted it kind of thing. You know, I wanted to find a hunting spot that kind of, you know, especially for mule deer, that I could find older age class bucks and be able to hunt mule deer and not run into pressure. So like I said, a lot of it's just gut intuition of knowing, you know, I've drove by here and there's not very many people, or there's not very many houses, or it's a long ways for people from the, you know, the suburbs, the city or whatever to drive and put a lot of pressure on these deer. Let's key in on those areas. And I hunt a lot with my buddy Rick, and every year we've got a checklist of places that we go check out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are, you know, a swing and a miss, and a lot of them are hitting the nail right on the head, and we're, you know, kind of abandoning old spots that weren't nearly as good. But it's just a revolving, you know, it's a revolving list. Just like, you know, Chad going out there looking for new country, he's got all his spots that he's learned his whole life that he can go to those spots and he can cherry pick through those spots and see which bucks are good up and coming bucks. If not, it's time to move on and find new country. And just, it's just an evolving game of spots. Basically, you got to have a backup plan after backup plan after backup plan. And that's where you got to love it. You've got to, you know, you just got to love it. So,
yeah, no, I agree. I think that's part of the fun of it. I think
he hit it right on the head with that one. I mean, it's just, I was born and raised here. I've lived here my whole life. I've covered this whole desert from Phoenix to Tucson to Yarnell all the way to Yuma.
And
have even ventured into California. And it's just, you gain knowledge over time. And you know what tends to hold deer or good bucks at times.
Mm-hmm.
And you just keep that record in your head. I write things down. I keep a running log from year to year, what weather patterns have happened. In the desert, you know, we don't get a lot of rain.
Yeah.
So it might rain one or two times in a 5 mile area, and then not rain for 15 to 20 miles across the desert. Well, it just moved all your deer that were in one of your best spots over to this new area. And it may take 5 or 6 years for those deer to get back over there, but that's still going to be a good spot.
Right.
Because the minerals in the ground, the layout, it, you just keep going back to them and just don't give up on them.
Yep. No, I agree. Got anything you want to add, Marlon?
I think that part of the reason why we're all such good buddies is the fact that we all kind of think alike. I mean, it's almost like you can do a podcast with one of us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chad and Travis just, they dump the nail on the head with a lot of this stuff. Look, I mean, if you notice common themes here, like, let's break it down for what it is, right? And John, I mean, anybody that, you know, wouldn't say that you're as hardcore as either of us, they're crazy, because you are. You love it just as much. You're just as passionate about it. you know, you actually are one of the guys out there trying to provide value to people, and, you know, getting people like us out there and kind of trying to gain insight on how things go. So, I mean, there's no loss of love. I mean, we're not the heroes here, and you're the unsung. I mean, you know, just as well as I do, and Chad and Travis, the fact of the matter is that, look, it's about being willing to do what others aren't. I mean, the gym and the protein and the freaking fitness, you know, I mean, that's all great and dandy, but there's giant bucks being killed with Twinkies and Snickers bars, okay?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Like, exactly. You should literally see our backcountry backpacks look like the freaking convenience store aisle of a freaking gas station along the freaking main interstate. That's like the facts of it. You know, people want to say, oh, I eat this and I do that and I work out. Yeah, I work out like a beast, but so does, you know, Chad, and so does Travis, and we get ready and we hike. And at the end of the day, it's like, not it, it really, at the end of the day, none of us drink. So boys, you want to like step up your game and do something about it? Quit going to friends, you know, sports parties, quit drinking, start focusing your effort on scouting, quit, you know, doing things that are leisure activities, and focus on the fact that you have a real goal in hunting. And in order to achieve it, you're going to have sacrifice. And that doesn't mean that those things are bad. It's just that there's always going to be compromise, right? When you decide to start a family and have kids, guess what? There's a compromise, you know, with hunting. It's the same thing. The common theme here is just that compromise. It's like, you're willing to give whatever it takes to taste that success. And that's why I candidly and firmly believe that 5% of the hunters take 95% of the game consistently year in and year out, because they're the ones that are willing to just do whatever it takes. And that's kind of my two cents, because I mean, I do the same things they do. And I mean, even, you know, locally close to me, 3 to 5 hours away, whether it's Arizona, California, or whatnot, I'm scouting my tail off. I'm every single week, I'm out 2 or 3 days a week looking at something. I provide myself with value so that that way come season, I'm not just sitting there going, well, geez, where do I go? Yeah, it's not a position I want to be in. Even if I can only kill a local buck that's 160-inch deer, well, that's like a 220-inch buck somewhere else. I know, you know, it looks like a small buck, but they don't grow them big where I hunt. And it's a feat to try and find something like that. And Chad knows, and Travis does too. I mean, we bust our tails and we hunt over-the-counter tags and kill the biggest stuff we can find in our areas.
Right. We had a couple of questions come in that I want to address, because I keep the feed moves so fast, I can't keep up with them. Real quick, we had somebody ask Chad if you ever think you'll kill a bigger buck than the old desert hog. But
you know, I don't want to say that I won't. The probability isn't there. I'm going to put the best effort I can into it. I'm looking for the typical class of that deer, to be perfectly honest. I've got goals. Marlon knows what they are. And I'm going to be disappointed if I don't get it done.
Yeah.
I've got goals, but at the same time, I'm not going to turn down solid bucks
to
achieve those goals.
Nope, bird in the hand. We had a question from Austin Atkinson, who asked about trail cameras. I'm gonna throw this at Travis. Do you use trail cameras to scout, and do you use them during the season?
You know, where I live, there's a lot of water, and unless you got a lot of time and a lot of cameras, you're gonna do a lot better with your glass. So where, you know, a lot of my hunting's done here in Idaho, there's just, you know, it's really, you know, it's wasted time when I can put boots on the ground.
So. Right. We had a question from Josh Deards, and you know what, Josh, buddy, I forgot what it was. I'm trying to remember them because they're disappearing. Like I said, I can only see like 5 or 6 at a time. So if you want to repost that, I'll definitely ask it. We just got a question from Chad. What would you say the home range is for a mule deer bucks in the Yuma area? Any tips on trending these deer in and off the season?
You know, I would say range is 10 to 15 miles on average. Once a mature buck sets up residence, he normally stays there. However, our weather is so severe down here that drought tends to move them at times. I did notice a vast area of our desert that is hit by drought over the last couple of years. The majority of our deer moved over towards agriculture. And I mean, we still had some deer out there to hunt, but a lot moved over to agriculture. And you know, it'll take a few years for them to move back, but you know, with years like this last one, it'll happen. And a lot of those deer traveled, you know, 20 to 25 miles, if that gives you any aspect on it.
Yeah. I personally, and I know you like to use trail cameras.
You know, that's been a touchy topic lately. Trail cameras on the desert, you know, they're helpful because of the water supply, but the same token, by the time it's hunting season, those deer are 4 to 5 miles at least from those water holes because they're man-made and they don't want to be there. And for guys that are against them, whether you're for it or against it, every time you take away somebody's rights or vote yes on something, you take away somebody's rights, whether you like it or not. And there'll be a time when something rolls around on your guys' side that you're not going to like, and just going to have to deal with it. So we just need to keep in mind that every time we pass a regulation, that it ends up hurting us in the long run.
Okay, we got a couple other questions. I'm gonna move away from the trail camera discussion. Josh Deers asked, when did you realize that you were next level? And I'm not sure which one of you guys he was, or which one of us, even if I was in that or not. but I'm gonna say, go ahead. When did you realize, Chad, that you were next level?
I'm on next level.
I think you're next level.
I don't look at it that way. I think I can do better. I've never looked at myself as next level. I think there's, you know, I look up to guys like you. I look up to Travis, you know, Marlin, and try to push myself.
Yeah.
But I've never been one to think that I'm better than anybody else, or, you know, I've had a good run.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of a big deal, so, you know, just kidding. Now, honestly, I like to think myself as just like everybody else. But I have a lot more time in the field, and I've been doing it for a long time. So I don't think I'm next level. I just think I spend a lot more time than most people do. You know, when you're spending at least 100 days a year hunting, you know, you end up killing more stuff. It's like anything else. You know, it's like the lottery. You can't win if you don't play. So, and I try to play as much as possible. So, Craig said, when you shoot a big toad like that, you're there. So you're there, Chad. Matt Howell asked if, anybody had any tips for relocating those high country mule deer after they've shed their velvet?
Yeah, we do it quite a bit. Matt, you know the country that we're in quite regularly. We hunted a big buck called Freak Nasty. He was living above timber all of July and August, and then shedded his velvet and ended up hanging out literally just inside the timber. So the big misnomer is, right, that these bucks are super transient, that they move a lot. They really don't. They're homebodies. They're super couch potatoes. They're in lazy mode. They're wherever it's like easiest pickings and less pressure. And I gotta be honest with you, like, pressure, that's secondary. Big bucks will deal with a lot of pressure. They'll be in some places where you sit there and look at it and go, really? I thought you were old, mature, and had some wisdom about you. You know, they put themselves in some really, what I would think would be silly places. But in all reality, they like to put themselves in places that are just easy, right? Easily accessible to escape routes, food, cover, water, all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I've seen 200 inch bucks, 190 inch bucks, just upper age class deer living in places where you would totally not expect them. So high country, 12,000 feet above timber. We've relocated lots of bucks within like a 2 square mile home range. That is their summer range. They're not going to leave it. So let's say, for instance, you locate your big trashy non-typical and you're like, oh my God, it's the buck of my dreams. You got to like literally sit there and ask yourself, okay, what's my highest and best use? Does that make sense? So you got to ask yourself, if I find this buck, am I willing to spend my whole season chasing him or end up with tag suit? That's the ultimate question, because he didn't leave. And that's the thing that's really important to take in. That buck didn't go anywhere. He's still there. He's just in a different pattern now. So when he loses velvet, all he did was basically change his routines and what he's, you know, what he's going to typically do. But he'll shed velvet and just go into the timber. And generally speaking, it's no more than, I would say, a quarter of a mile to a third of a mile from his original summer bed. And a lot of times it's right below his original summer bed. Like it'll be generally in the same basin.
Assuming all the feed and the water and all that other stuff stays there.
It's always there though.
Yeah.
It's the feed and the water is always there. The feed and the water is not going to be the problem when they get out of velvet like that. It's going to be more weather induced. Like for instance, last year in high country, we had a heck of a time even finding a deer. I mean, there was 2 feet of snow at 12,500 feet on opening day.
Jeez.
And every single buck that was, you know, in a position where we could hunt him prior to season was basically like way into the timber. They were bedding, you know, 1,000 feet below the timber line. But they didn't leave. It's just that you got to know, like, let's say you're an out of state hunter, like, you know, like I am for the high country. I can't invest a whole month trying to pursue one deer. I'll waste all my time there and I will end up with nothing. So I got to like think highest and best use. I have, even if it's a big buck, I got to kind of like be willing to move on knowing that there's a big buck there. And if I spend my time hunting him, there's a chance I could catch up to him. Also a chance I might not. So for me, it's one of those things where I'm still in that wheelhouse where I like to put stuff on the ground as long as it's decent. I'm not a 200 or bust kind of person. I if I see a 165 or a 170, like I'm just as giddy and happy as I were if it was 200 inches. I mean, don't get me wrong. I haven't killed a 200 inch buck yet. Like Chad and Travis, they've both reached that mark. I haven't.
Nor have I.
you know, but I'm not the kind of guy either that's going to pass up a good solid 165, 170 on day four. Like on day one, I'm never shooting that buck. But on day four, I'm not passing him up. That like, I'll give it a little while, but they don't leave the summer range, to answer Matt's question.
I won't pass them up on day two. So day one, I'll give them a bus pass. But we had a couple other questions come in. One from Ron Nixon. The other one was from Brandon Brooks. Actually, I think you were directing it to me. I'm not sure. He asked if is it true that you always approach a mid ridge buck or a, you know, a buck that's hanging out halfway up of the mountain from above? And there's no rule. I mean, there's rules of thumbs, you know, where certain things, but whatever the wind is doing is how you're approaching them. Whichever way they're facing is how you're picking your approach. I mean, I don't think coming from above or below, I mean, yeah, maybe above is a little bit easier at times, but it just given the terrain, you know, sometimes below is better. And it's something about mule deer that I've noticed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like if you come from above them and they catch movement, they're going to explode out. But if you're coming from below them and they catch movement, they'll stand there and they'll give you that mule deer look back or whatever, and they might hop off a little bit and then stop. And it kind of gives you an opportunity, to make a shot. And I don't know, it seems to, I'm not a very sneaky person, so my shots are always fast and furious. That's why I practice running and shooting and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know if you guys got anything else to add to that, but I'll take that as a no. The other question was from Ron Nixon, and back on the trail cameras, he was asking, have you ever had a deer sit there and stare at a trail camera and then never show back up?
No. Not unless that wasn't his normal ground.
Right.
I've never had that happen.
Yeah. And honestly, if they didn't show back up, it's hard to say, because how did you handle that trail camera? Is your stench all over it?
The good thing about the desert, was it a fluke that you
caught him once?
If he did leave that water hole, he's at the next one. So somewhere close.
That's kind of, something that's interesting too, though. Like that answer is very highly dependent to your geographic region of hunt. Like you can't, that's not a blanket answer, because areas where there's not a lot of water, those deer are relying on it. If they don't hit that same tank, and those tanks can be spaced, 12, 14, 15 miles apart, just depending on the tank. Those deer, when it's 100, 105, 110, they don't go any more than 3 to 4 miles from water. They are literally within that circumference. So from their standpoint, they were born there. The mother gave birth to the fawn there, and they learn home range because they don't migrate, right? The does tend to follow precipitation around, but in the summertime they're stuck to water. So they're raised and they learn these areas because that's where they were born. And they don't really deviate from that. Now, if you're hunting a high country buck and you have a high country buck kind of that you see on a cam, he might not show up, especially if it's July or early August. If it's July or early August and you have him on camera, he could be 10, 15 miles away, depending on where his migration grounds are and where he was, where he was born, can change significantly.
Can I interrupt you a quick moment?
Yeah.
So I just had something pop in my head. I've set trail cameras up on actual trails going into the water, back set them 50, 60 yards before the water itself. And yeah, they don't like them. They change their direction and they'll start a new trail. So do they like the camera? No. If they have to water there, they'll put up with it. But like Marlon's saying, if there's abundance of water and you put a camera out, more than likely you're going to change his habits a little bit. And that's with any camera. I haven't seen one that they haven't noticed.
Okay. Oh, well, I got a lot of trail camera footage of bucks, and when I use a trail camera, I don't use it in the desert very often. I use it a lot up like in the Ponderosas and stuff like that, or if I back in the day when I used to set out salt licks and whatnot, I never really noticed that it affected them. I've had them come up and lick the damn camera before.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think it's one of those things. It's, it's possible. Yeah. You get a really skittish, buck that doesn't tolerate anything. Yeah. He's going to notice it, obviously, but is it enough to blow him out of there? I guess it just depends on the buck. So, Chad, how many trail cameras do you run? David Rydell wants to know.
Last year, I think I ran 3 for a few weeks. I did most of my work on the ground. This last couple weeks, I've had 6 different cameras out. I've already pulled them. It just depends on how much time I have. I'm looking for something special before they shed. I try to keep better tabs on them. So, but it's so green, I'm really not having any luck at water. So, I've had as many as 10 out this last year we didn't do much with cameras.
Right.
The year before we had, what do we have, 10 Marlin?
At least. I think there was a couple that, we had a lot out, 10, 12.
And then the year before that, I didn't run, I think I had one weekend's worth of pictures of that big buck. I pulled my camera in August. I'd basically had enough of taking pictures of him. Right. So it just depends on the year.
Yeah. We just got a good question from Austin Atkinson. For a newbie archery mule deer hunter, which state should they start with? Colorado, Idaho, Arizona, Utah? I tend to think, and I've hunted all those states, I tend to think that Arizona for me, well, I guess it depends on the time of year, because in the rut, not so much. But for early season hunt, I think is probably the hardest out of all of them, unless you're willing to sit water and just sit water, you know, for 7 days, knowing that you're not going to see a damn deer except for one, and it'd be that one buck.
Well, that aren't our numbers are.
Oh yeah.
Aren't what other states are.
I like Utah. I think Utah, hands out. I've been to Utah 3 times and I killed all 3 times. But I don't know. Colorado's good too, though. I don't know. They're all good. Well, I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Utah's a good state. Let's just kind of keep them out of Idaho here. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've hunted Idaho. I've actually never killed a deer in Idaho, so maybe that's why it's not on my list. But I think I like Utah because the numbers are high. And this is, we're talking about a newbie archery mule deer hunter. We're not talking about trophy hunting. My answer probably would have changed had you said that, you know, had it been a like, you know, where could a guy get a bigger, cause I would say Colorado for sure. Cause I don't know. I think number of big deer in Colorado are, to me, I've seen more big deer there than I've seen. I mean, you see really big bucks in Arizona, but they're few and far between compared to Colorado. You know, I guess it all depends. I'm going to shut up. Let you guys talk.
What about hunting whitetail? I mean, that would be good for a newbie.
Yeah.
Chad's trying to like direct traffic here. Nebraska's a great place, you know. Florida, Texas Panhandle.
Actually, Florida's got a shit ton of deer, man. Oh, Texas is retarded. Texas is actually retarded, man. It's I don't have any of you guys actually hunted Texas, because I have several times, and it's like,
yeah,
it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's crazy.
That would probably be the best place for a newbie archery hunter to go, if you can afford to go.
Yeah, but he's talking about mule deer. A newbie archery mule deer hunter. And actually, mule deer in Texas is very tough.
I would hunt probably northern AZ, something like that.
Yeah. If it was me, I'd find a hunt that you can get every year, you know, a good over-the-counter hunt or something that you can get a hunt. And year after year, you can kind of evolve yourself as a hunter if you're a beginner. It's gonna be better to stick to an area and be able to learn as you go.
Yeah. Travis gave the best advice there. That's the honest question, is go where you can get a lot of practice. Go where you can like really consistently draw a tag, and that's where you're going to see yourself get the most gains out of your hunting endeavors, that you're going to allow yourself to basically have hallowed ground. I talked about that in a few magazine articles and another podcast before, where, you know, we got to kind of hunt off the scraps, so to speak, if we want to get good at something.
Right.
Because trying to put in for these draws, I mean, any more with point creep and you start talking about success in some of these limited draw units that we might get once every 10 years. I mean, 5 years if it's not such a good hunt, 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, they're really almost like, it's becoming the type of thing where it's like this significant bonus and it's this huge thing that you just drew a tag, but it's still not even filled. So the expectation is almost so much greater on you to, like, you know, do the tag justice. Sometimes it becomes a little crazy. So I think that, you know, I'm the kind of guy that actually did what that question was, you know, the derivative of that question. I don't live in mule deer country. I have to drive 5 hours to even touch mule deer country. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, at least four. And so Arizona is great because there's still over the counter hunts that are really decent that you can put your work in and still get a good buck. Unfortunately, Travis, you know, Idaho has good opportunity too, but the thing is, it's never going to affect Travis because, you know, he does his own research in places that an out-of-stater is just never going to go. Like, he hunts country where you look at it, you know, same as the desert where we hunt, you look at it and go, there's no way anything lives here. And so it's kind of like, you got to hunt those over-the-counter opportunity type hunts and just kind of build up some kills.
Yeah, I agree. The more practice you get, and the places that give you the most opportunities are typically the best places to start off as a newbie hunter. You know, even if there's a lot of people hunting there, because, I mean, I've hunted pressured deer my whole life. I'm not much of a backcountry hunter, so I learned how to hunt where other people are hunting, just thinking outside the box. We just got a good question in from Brandon Glenn. Tips on closing the gap the last 100 yards. You know, Travis, I'll let you and your sneaky feet over there take over that question. Free plug time.
Well, I mean, in all seriousness, you know, when you get within 150 yards, it's time to slow down. And, you know, being quiet and keeping the wind in your face and just moving slow is probably one of the biggest, the biggest things that have helped me. You know, when I finally figured it out, you know, when I was younger, I would find a buck and I'd always seem to blow him out. You know, the stalks wouldn't work. And now I'm to the point where if I don't get in bow range, something's wrong. Like, you know, most every stalk I've been in for the last, you know, 5-6 years, most of them I get in bow range. And it's because I slow down. You know, mule deer pick up on movement for one, you know. Even if you're standing, you don't need to crawl. You don't need to just use the land in the way that it's best to get in on a buck and just go slow, move slow. Get yourself a pair of, you know, Rimrock stalkers or sneaky feet or a pair of wool socks. Just get something that's going to give you an edge to be quiet and, you know, the confidence that you need to close the gap. So.
Get Rimrock stalkers.
All right, now, guys. I'm a sneak tech guy. I was joking. No, actually, you do make some. Those are amazing stalking boots. But no, I agree with you. And I think I remember talking with Marlon about it, and you said it best. If you think you're going slow, you're going too fast. And that's good advice. I've actually said that to myself several times since you told me that several years back. And it's actually helped me slow down a little bit because I am a go, 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 go person. And I kill things despite my stupidity. So I think I could be even more successful if I would just slow the hell down. Got a question. Oh, go ahead. You want to say something?
I was just going to kind of add to that, John, and that, you know, the thing is there's a time to be really aggressive, okay, mm-hmm. and get into the hunt, and then there's, you know, a time to slow down. And realistically, I mean, mule deer are very reliant on their senses. With that being said, they're not super, super focused simply on just one sense. And if you're a student of their body language, and you become a student of their behavior, and you understand what their ear positions at, you understand how their eyes operate and what they're looking at, And you understand whether they're chewing their cud. Believe it or not, there's little subtle things like when they're chewing their cud, it sounds silly, but their head has vibration in it. And if you tune into that, you could stand up. And I don't recommend it, but if it's your only option, you can stand up and clear view of them. If you're, especially if you're not silhouetted, you can stand up and clear view. Like you were saying, you know, being below them and approaching. If they're bedded up and you're not silhouetted, you can take slow movements straight at them with their eyes gently closed, not even, you know, sleeping, but chewing their cud, ears pinned back, face headed like at a 90 degree angle from you. I've stood straight up and taken steps towards bucks and, you know, cut the distance from 120 yards down to like 70. As soon as you start, there's a weird barrier. There's a barrier at like 160 to about 90. As soon as you get inside of like 80, it's almost like there's a room there that you can make a lot, not a lot of noise, but more noise than you can make at 150, believe it or not, because it's almost like in their comfort zone. It's almost like in their wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. They'll be crashing, not crashing through, but you'll be step, not like placing your knee or your hand on little pebbles and little rocks that kind of make like a little grinding, gritty noise or a snapping of a little bush. And it's almost okay because it's natural for their environment. They're used to it. And then the rhythm of their body language is more important to focus on with that. That's really what, you know, I think if I'm going to give value to somebody right now, key in and become a student of the deer and really understand what they're doing. That's going to give you such a huge edge.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you know, and on top of, you know, knowing when to be aggressive and knowing when to go slow in general, you're right though. If you think you're going slow enough, slow down some more.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We got, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, just listening to him, I mean, it lets you think a little bit, you know, you kind of just need to be in tune with the hunt. Like, yeah, you need to move slow, but just like Marlon said, keying in on what the animal is doing and adjusting to their behavior is everything. That will pay dividends in the end.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it is that not every situation is doable, and you need to know when you can go and when you can't go. This last January buck, I sat 120 yards over the top of him for 4 hours. Things weren't right. I knew the sun was going to move him from where he was laying. I knew he was going to move his bed. It did. He moved down range and things slipped up a little bit. He gave me an open window and it worked out. I was willing to leave. I was willing to leave him there and try him again at a better time. I would recommend, I mean, in this just goes to going and hunting and practicing and spending time in the field, is I put stalks on a lot of animals and it's not hunting season.
Yep.
Like Marlon said, you know, learning the animal, getting some knowledge on behavior and what they like, what they don't like.
Yep.
That helps a ton.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I actually wrote that in my book years ago, that I, one of the things I did for a long time is I'd practice just going stalking animals, you know, without my bow or whatever, you know, and then I even added my gear too, because, you know, wearing a pack or whatever changes things up. Hell, I put stalks on my dog all the damn time just to see if I could sneak up on him. You know, start hunting coyote in the off season and try to glass them up and put stalks on coyote. You get a coyote and spot and stalk, you can get a deer for sure. So, anyway, we got three questions that came across that I want to address here before we get off this call. Two of them I'm going to take real quick. Brandon Brooks asked, do you guys use a decoy during the rut? I don't.
No.
I do for whitetail if I'm sitting in a tree stand, but not for spot and stalk. I think it's too cumbersome and whatnot. What about you, Travis?
I think it could, you know, it could be effective and it could have its place, but you know, that's just one more thing I got to carry in my backpack. So
yeah, that's my thought process. Anything I could leave out of the backpack, I'm good with. John Breitzman just asked if in the low country, when do you start scouting for the second season? I'm assuming he's talking, he's in for Arizona boy. I'm assuming he's talking about hunting the rut here. And my answer is never stop scouting. For if you're hunting the rut, I'm always looking for where the does are at. Because where the does are at, that's where the boys are going to come show up eventually.
So there's a look Rick, for that. And there's another question on here that has to do with deer in the flats. And most of my pictures seem like they're in the flats. Most of my pictures seem like they're in the flats because I don't want to take pictures of ridgelines.
Yep.
A lot of your big bucks like to hide out. They like to get in little crevices and be reclusive. When you find those areas, they don't just show up during the rut. They're there the whole time. They're just hiding.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, guys will be seeing a lot of deer during the beginning of the rut, and there's deer everywhere. And the next weekend, I'll get a message, hey, where'd all my deer go? Do you know where my deer might have went? And they're back in the crevices. You know, they quit being in the flats. The big bucks got them. And they're tucked back home where they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
You're sure there are deer out in the flats too. Some of those bucks are kind of impossible, just because they set themselves up to be able to see forever. There'll be one Palo Verde in the middle of a Malapai and nothing else around it for a mile, and there'll be a big buck laying under it. You're not closing the deal on him. You'll fly over him and see him, but that's about all you're going to do.
Okay, so I guess you kind of already addressed what Anthony was asking, that in a nutshell. I think a lot of that has to do with where you're hunting though too. Cause I feel like up down there in Yuma. Yeah, totally. Totally can see that. But up here where it's, you know, a lot more roll. Our flats aren't really flats like they are down there with it. I mean, those are freaking Bonneville flats down there, you know? So, I think over here, like in a Phoenix area or even north of here or even Tucson, I think it's a different story. I think a good rule of thumb is keep tabs on the does. If you're just planning on hunting the rut and bucks are going to be showing up, and then let your eyes do the work. I think that's the easiest thing for a guy to add into his tool bag. Because if you're going to be like this guy, you got to be a freaking mathematician and a statistician and a scientist to figure out what these bucks are doing all the time. It's going to be a lot harder on you, and you need to spend the time. So,
well, one thing to keep in mind here is be mindful that does tend to have a particular area that they stay and they live and they'll die.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to move as much as a lot of people might think. They, have a home just like you or I, and they're not going anywhere. So be mindful of the fact that if you just find, during the rut, I'm speaking to, even before the rut, you find your doe groups, they're going to be close to water and feed, because they're most often going to have yearlings. If it's an area that has, two or three, four or five does, whatever. The desert's fiercely competitive, and Chad can, attest to this probably more than I can, but I will say just from my experience over the last decade, the does are going to be very much so centered around feed and water, especially for the youngsters, right? The yearlings and the newborns. So, if you just don't even pay attention to looking for bucks, like, forget about where the bucks are. Forget about what the bucks are doing. Forget about anything having to do with anything with horns on its head. If you're hunting a rut, just focus on, you know, where the ladies are at, right?
Yeah.
You do that, you're going to be just fine. If you find the doe groups, then all you need to do is put in your head, you know, on your little map in your head where these doe groups are, and just alternate, you know, as the rut closes in, like, start getting up on high spots above your doe groups and make, just do a circuit, like, every day, do a different circuit, check your does out. And eventually, if you have a good rut hunt tag where, you know, you're going to hit the peak of the rut in that group of does, and you know that there's big bucks in the area, he's going to be on them, unless it's super, super hot, or it's a full moon, then they're going to do it at night. But in general, like, you can have a ton of success just finding does.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. I unless you're trying to hunt a specific buck, then it's a completely different story. Well, we got two other questions that I want to hit before we get off this call. Bill Babish, who is a muley killing fool and basically kills a buck every year in Arizona. His question is, when guys bust out bucks and chase them into next country, a lot of times if you stay put, that buck will come back. Do you guys have that same experience? I'd say, yeah, I've seen it many, many times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously try not to.
It just depends. I think it depends on how hard the rut. How hard the rut's going too. Like, you know, sometimes they'll freaking throw caution to the wind because they're so just hell bent on getting that. I guess unless the does went with them too, that's another thing, you know. But yeah, no, I agree with you, Bill. I've definitely seen that. I've seen it with you, shit, you know. So
I think if you bust them during the rut, they're coming back. If you bust them during a normal rifle season or something like that, they'll cover some miles. That I watched a buck. Well, I watched three bucks run. I don't know. We watched a guy make a stalk on some deer and blow them out. And I was looking through the COAs, and they were literally half a mile down in front of me, and I watched them run clear out of sight on flat ground. So
yeah,
those deer probably weren't coming back.
Probably not. They're not. They go that far for sure. Last question. John Rush asked, let's see. Water, do you think about blacktail deer hunting in Northern California? I'm sorry, I don't know. Actually, I thought I understood what the question was, but I guess it's, do you hunt on water in blacktail country in Northern California? I'm gonna throw that to you, Marlon, because I don't know other than myself.
I'd hunt blacktail, but Marlon would probably kill me.
Blacktail. You know, blacktail are a very reclusive animal. There's a ton of people that hunt blacktail on water. Something to be cognizant of with hunting blacktail on water is, if you're going to do it, make sure it's like natural water or private property. You have to have access to private property. If you have access to private property, your chances of being undisturbed on like a cattle guzzler or something like that is pretty good. If you're not hunting private property and you're trying to hunt water on blacktails, you're kind of wasting your time, because those bucks will pretty much all go nocturnal. I've seen it happen over and over again. I'll set up a camera on something that's accessible to even hikers. Come right around when they shed velvet. A lot of those ones shed velvet in like August. And on the coastal, the mid coast here, they'll shed velvet in like end of July. Those bucks will go nocturnal immediately, unless it's natural water. If it's natural water, you have to hike back into a steep canyon and it's super, super solitary, and you know that nobody else is back there, you'll have a chance to catch that buck in the morning or the evening for sure.
Yeah.
But it has to do with blacktail and pressure are hand in hand. Like if there's any pressure, you can count on it being in the dirtiest, darkest, nastiest little hole. I mean, it can be blackberry briars 6-7 feet around. They'll figure out a way to tunnel in to that stuff behind it in little tiny pathways that, you know, you or I couldn't fit down, you know, crawling hands and knees with a bow, but yeah, you'll get a mature buck to get through it somehow. So yeah, that's how critical it is to hunt undisturbed natural water sources if you want to try and kill one on water. Or it's, like I said, private property. Because the whole key here with a blacktail is pressure.
It's pressure. Yep. Yeah. They act a lot like whitetail. Well, guys, I'm going to wrap it up. We've been kind of went over the hour here. I'm sure we got questions still coming through and stuff like that, but I'll save those questions for the next time or from when I have you guys on individually. We'll address those then. I want to thank everybody for taking the time and tuning into this podcast. There's a very good group of guys asking questions and stuff out there. So thank you guys. And Travis, thanks for coming on, and Marlon, and you know, one more thing, guys, help me keep this podcast free. If you subscribe and leave a review, it helps me with my ratings and helps me keep my sponsors paying for this podcast. So I can give you this awesome information for free. So Interviews with the Hunting Masters on Podbean. You catch us on iTunes, Google Play, pretty much anywhere you can find podcasts. We are in all those directories. So thank you again. And don't forget, we're giving away a Matthews Halon 32 to one of those fans in the beginning of June. Thanks a lot.
Hey, John, thank you for making you know, this available to everybody and for having us on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right.
Thanks for the invite. This thing could have definitely just kept going.
I'm sure we could sit here and talk all night about mule deer. So we all love them to death. So literally to death. So all right, guys, take it easy.